May it please the court, counsel. I am Jersey M. Green, registration number 13251. I am counsel for Kevin Fight and trial counsel for him in the case below. I see this case as involving basically three questions. They are, first, is Kevin Fight the prevailing party for purposes of the party's contract, attorney fees provision of the contract? Secondly, must the trial court identify a prevailing party, and specifically him as the prevailing party? And thirdly, must the trial court award attorney fees to Mr. Fight as the prevailing party? With respect to each of those questions, the answer is yes. I propose to take them in the same sequence unless the court prefers a different arrangement. There appears to be no dispute in, between the parties that the net judgment rule applies to this case. The factual basis for this is that there were two judgments entered, or two awards made, two monetary awards made, one to CMB Development, the other to Kevin Fight. The larger amount was for Kevin Fight. The court then applied the net judgment rule and entered a judgment in his favor for some slightly less than $2,000. Under the Spencer Contractor case, because we are dealing with a contract dispute, he is the prevailing party, according to Spencer Contractor, for purposes of an attorney fees provision. It's also important to
recognize. Is that based just on a straight net judgment, subtract, add, whatever comes up, whoever's got the most dollars is declared the winner?
Exactly. There is one caveat. That there could be circumstances in which you would not declare a prevailing party. The court in Spencer Contractor cited a case from Illinois, Illington versus Bouchon, in which the court in that case said there could be circumstances where we wouldn't declare a prevailing party if on one side of the case there was an equitable claim in which a party prevailed, on the other side of the case there was a contract claim in which a party prevailed. In that case, for purposes of an attorney fees provision, we might not declare one or the other under the net judgment rule as being the prevailing party for the attorney fees provision.
Didn't the Supreme Court say in the Spencer Contractor case, Mr. Green, that trial court has discretion to determine who the prevailing party is?
Yes, and that remains the law. If you think about the discretion of the court always has discretion to determine who the prevailing party is. However, as we apply jurisprudence, we can only define that when we look at specific case samples. When we distill down a case such as this, we have a very clear articulation of the law as to the extent to which the court's discretion is abused. So we have, generally, the trial court is empowered to exercise its discretion. As a matter of jurisprudence, we have to define at some point what constitutes an abuse of that discretion. It's always case specific.
So, but as I understand your position, a trial court could not exercise its discretion and conclude that there is no prevailing party. Is that correct?
In this case, but this, I'm talking about a very specific case.
Well, why? What is your basis for that conclusion?
One. Kevin Fight was the only party who prevailed on a claim involving a contract attorney fees provision. The CMB party prevailed on an oral contract in which there was no attorney fees provision. Hence, Kevin Fight is the only party to have prevailed on the contract that contains the attorney fees provision. He also is under the net judgment rule the prevailing party, so he's both the prevailing party by virtue of the contract containing the provision, and secondly is the prevailing party by operation of the net judgment rule.
Let me just ask you hypothetically, if there was a case where there were claims and counterclaims and one side came out with, under the net judgment rule, with a judgment of, say, $10, would the trial court in that case have to determine that that party was the prevailing party?
Yes, subject then to a determination, this is where the trial court exercises its discretion as to the reasonableness of the fees that were claimed.
So in that regard, could a trial court say continuing with my hypothetical, okay, you've only obtained a judgment of $10, and therefore, even though you've requested $100,000 in attorney's fees, I'm only going to award you $1,000 in attorney's fees. Would that be permissible?
Well, we don't have that in this case. To answer your question.
I'm just asking a hypothetical question.
Yeah, to answer your question, let's say, for example, if I can take and dovetail that, that hypothetical. Let's say that I have sued on a promissory note, a $1,500 promissory note, and I've spent $8,000 getting a default judgment. We can all agree that's probably not going to pass as a reasonable attorney fees. On the other hand, if I have spent 2 days in trial overcoming the defendant's defenses, that's a different question. But a trial court should not focus simply on what the amount of the award was, because the rules that set forth what constitutes a reasonable attorney fees comprises eight factors. How much has been recovered is only one of those eight factors that the court has to take into account. Have I answered your question satisfactorily?
With all due respect, I'm not sure that you have.
Okay.
I would like to know, again, in with regard to my specific hypothetical, if a party obtains a judgment of $10 under the net judgment rule, is there any way, under any circumstance, that that party could be awarded $100,000 in attorney's fees?
Yes, I believe that they can. You have freedom of contract. You have sophisticated parties that have entered into a contract that says the prevailing party. Note that this provision doesn't say the substantially prevailing party. It says the prevailing party. If it said substantially prevailing party, then we could look at your hypothetical, Judge Talman, and we could say, well, you're not the substantially prevailing party. But that's not what this contract says. This contract says the prevailing party.
But it doesn't really define prevailing party, the contract, right?
No. We have to look at the case law to determine who the prevailing party is.
Because we also have, as I understand it, the plaintiff prevailing on six claims and your client prevailing on one. Do we take that into consideration, or does the trial court take that into consideration?
Well, CMB only prevailed on one claim. It was a claim that we confessed.
And you withdrew three claims.
Yes.
And then they went on three of the counterclaims that you brought.
Well, yes, they went on three counterclaims. But the one claim that we won on is the one involving the attorney fees provision.
So my question was, does the trial court not take that into consideration as well, the different number of claims that are being brought and the counterclaims are being brought and the defenses raised and so forth?
Not at the stage of determining who the prevailing party is for purposes of the attorney fees provision. The party specified a prevailing party, the court shall award. That language necessarily binds the court, actually divests the court of jurisdiction to say no. The Court of Appeals and other panel of this court, 4 months after the trial court's decision, concluded that shall award means shall award. An arbiter has no discretion but shall award attorney fees.
Which division was that? Which?
The panel was Chief Judge Davidson, Metzer, and Kapelke.
That was the Wheeler case?
No, that was Maginus.
Okay, because in the Wheeler case, didn't they also say that in a proper case, the trial court may rule that neither party prevailed and award no fees?
Yes, they did not cite a Penn site so that we really know what they're looking at, but the only reference to that appears in the citation to the Illinois case by Spencer Contractor, in which they're specifying, well, in a proper case, what we mean is if there is an equitable award paired up against a contractual award, that may be what we mean as a proper case. We don't have a decision from a Colorado court that says this is what is meant when the reference is made to a proper case, but inferentially, they relate it back to Spencer Contractor, and Spencer Contractor relates it directly to the Ellington versus Bouchon case. So.
Well, is it your position then that CMB did not win any claim relating to litigation relating to this contract?
That's correct. They won only on an oral contract. There was no attorney fees component to that oral contract. It is a claim that we offered to confess and which they accepted in dismissal of all of their other claims.
And so that claim did not relate to the subject matter of this contract?
It did relate to the subject matter of the contract. It had to do with the finish of the caretaker unit and which is part of the mix. And then the express claim that Mr. Feit had, the breach of express warranty claim, had to do with the construction of the house as a whole. And so there's not a convenient way for us to parse that out intellectually to say what was related to what. I think it's all part of the same mix. However, if you look at the way they drafted their complaint on the third claim for relief, which was their oral contract claim, they expressly left out any allegation that they were entitled to recovery of attorney fees. To follow up on this issue of the what the court must do and the extent and the limitations on its discretion, the way this attorney fees provision is drafted, it necessarily, as was the case in Wheeler, says to the trial court, you have to decide. This is a shall award provision to the prevailing party, not that the prevailing party shall be entitled to or may be allowed. It says shall award. The court shall award. You can't shall award until you decide who the prevailing party is. Necessarily, you have to make a decision as to who the prevailing party is.
So if the case were to be remanded back to the trial court could rule either way, I guess.
It could rule either way. I mean, once we're back in front of the trial court, that's when the trial judge then addresses the criteria for determining the reasonableness of the fees. And, you know, could conclude that, for the amount of money that was spent, I don't think this is a reasonable attorney fees. Or he could, but the fact of the matter is he didn't reach that part of the analysis.
So with regard to the reasonableness of the attorney's fees, can the trial court or should the trial court take into account the degree of success achieved by that prevailing party?
Well, that's one of the results obtained is one of the eight criteria. So yes, that has to be something the trial court takes into account. But if you look at these cases, that sometimes is given a lesser weight, frankly, than what was the amount of the claim. How much were we actually chasing after, which goes back to my, I'm sorry.
Right, no, I'm just.
Which goes back to my description. You know, if you were chasing, in this case, Mr. Feit was chasing what amounted to about $700,000 with the damages that he claimed plus pretrial interest. And so was it reasonable in that light to have invested that much money chasing it? If it was a $1,500 promissory note, no, it wouldn't be reasonable at all. But you don't necessarily get kicked out of court just simply because the actual judgment that you entered was less than what you expected or that your attorney fees were less than what you expected.
Right. Now, the reason I'm asking my question is because I think we're concerned or at least I'm concerned about the practicalities of the situation. And in the first instance, as you say, determining the prevailing party. But in the second instance, how is the court to determine the reasonable amount of attorney's fees when each side has prevailed on some claims for relief, whether by actual litigation or because one side withdrew certain claims that it originally brought forth?
Well, that's part of the mix to the extent that it fits into the eight factors to be determined. I'm sure that the trial court would address it appropriately.
Okay, thank you.
I will reserve what's left of my time unless the court has other questions for me at this point.
Please, court. Excuse me. Good afternoon. My name is Kelly Dude, and it really is Dude, D-U-D-E, of the law firm of Anderson, Dude, and LaBelle. I get asked that question a lot, and I just wanted to clarify. Colorado Springs, my attorney registration number is 13208. I think what's been lost in this whole discussion is you can pull a particular Colorado case and another Colorado case and a third Colorado case, and it might support a fraction of what Mr. Green is telling you. But when you consider them as a whole and apply them to this case, I think it's pretty clear that the trial court made the correct decision. Under any theory, whether it's attorney fee provision by statute, by rule of civil procedure, or by contract, the trial court necessarily has discretion within any of those rules to determine what is reasonable. I mean, by the very fact that it uses the word reasonable gives the trial court discretion. What Mr. Green, and by the way, I just want to clarify, I was not the trial attorney in this case, but another partner of mine in my firm was. But what Mr. Green attempts to persuade you is that because of the Spencer case, because he had in a contract a provision that said the prevailing party shall be awarded its attorney fees, and since in our case we prevailed on an oral contract, that somehow that trumps it because the oral contract did not have in it a fee provision. However, that argument completely ignores the Colorado Supreme Court case of Agritrack versus DeJohn Housemoving Inc., a decision written by Justice Corliss in 2001. And what she decided was that in a case where an express contract, I mean an oral contract or implied contract, it arises out of the subject matter of the express contract, and the oral contract is in fact consummated after the written contract, in those circumstances that oral contract incorporates the terms of the express contract, and in fact you may be entitled to attorney fees. Specifically on page 1193, she writes, the Court of Appeals held that attorney fees could not be awarded for breach of an implied contract where the damages arose by their very nature outside of the express contract. We disagree. There is no evidence in the record that the implied in fact contract modified the fee shifting provision contained in the subcontract. The implied contract was subsequent to the express contract. And so she goes on to say that here the dispute over the contract implied in fact, although it pertained to work outside of the contract, arose from the express contract between the parties. It involved the same subject matter, the airport job, and same type of claim based on contract. And in that circumstance, obviously then, the fact that the express contract has language that says the prevailing party shall prevail does not trump an oral contract that arose, as Mr. Green acknowledged, out of the same circumstance. So,
Mr. Dude, yes. Assuming you're correct in that assertion, let me go back to the first point that Mr. Green was raising in determining the prevailing party. Under the Dennis Spencer contractor case, do you think that a court has the discretion to say that neither party prevailed, or do you think that the trial court must say one party prevailed?
I think they absolutely have the discretion, and I think a fair reading of that case illustrates that, because why would the court have gone through the process of analyzing that the city of Aurora, in fact, really didn't prevail on anything? In fact, they found that the city of Aurora had breached both the express contract and the settlement agreement. It didn't prevail on anything. Why would the court even go through that process if there was a strict rule that whoever is the prevailing party is automatically entitled to attorney fees? It went through the process. My presumption from that case, honestly, is, Your Honor, is that if the court had found that the city of Aurora, in breach of the settlement agreement, had been able to assert that there was some damages, then might have had a different result. We don't know. But the point of the matter is, they found, as opposed to our case, that the city of Aurora hadn't prevailed on either issue, on either breach of contract claim. And I think what's important to consider here is that while the plaintiff in this case prevailed on only one claim, it's the only claim we had. We prevailed 100% on the claim that we had. We had different theories, but the bottom line is we recovered everything that we asked for. Mr. Green's client, on the other hand, had six claims, of which they only prevailed on one. And so I think the trial court necessarily has to have the discretion, first of all, to determine who's the prevailing party, and second of all, if they make that determination, what is a reasonable attorney fees?
Are you aware of any authority, either in Colorado or in any other state, where the court has held on an attorney fee breach of contract provision that the trial court has the discretion to determine that neither party was the prevailing party?
I do, Your Honor, if I can find it, and I'm hoping. In the case of Archer versus Farmer Brothers Company, it's a Colorado Supreme Court case from 2004, 90 P. 3rd, 228. When a case involves many, this is quoting on page 231 of that decision, when a case involves many claims, some of which are successful and some of which are not, it is left to the sole discretion of the trial court to determine which party, if any, is the prevailing party and whether costs should be awarded.
But was the Archer case a case that involved a contractual fee shifting provision or a statutory provision?
If you'll give me a second, please. I don't know if it did, but I think the bottom line is this. As I said initially, any of the three ways that a court can award attorney fees, either by statute, by civil procedure rule, or by a provision in a contract, necessarily the trial court is going to have discretion. First of all, it has to determine who's the prevailing party. The contract didn't define who the prevailing party was, but all contracts, as you are well aware, in Colorado and elsewhere, have to be read in a reasonable manner. And therefore, in this particular case, the trial court looked at the fact that the defendant asked for $700,000 plus and recovered on net less than $2,000. The plaintiff, on the other hand, recovered every single dollar that it asked for, and the trial court, under the circumstances, exercised necessarily its judgment to determine what was reasonable and who was the prevailing party. And in this case, the trial court determined there really wasn't a prevailing party. Now,
may I ask you a question about prevailing party? Is the question that of liability, or is the question that of damages, or is it a mixture of both?
Well, I think ultimately, from reading the cases, it gets down to a question of damages. What proportion of what you were asking for did you actually recover? I think that's the logical way it has to go. And let me tell you why. For example, let's say that the plaintiff sues for $50,000. The defendant counterclaims for $50,000. On a different theory, on a different issue. And the trial court finds in favor of both. Okay? But decides that the damages the plaintiff should recover are $1,001, and decides the damages the defendant should recover is $1,000. So there's a $1 difference. Now, Mr. Green would tell a trial court, you have no discretion to determine whether the plaintiff actually prevailed or not, or whether that's reasonable or not. Since they recovered $1 more, you've got to award the plaintiff's attorney their attorney fees. And the attorney fees could be $40,000 or $50,000 for a $1 award. Obviously, that makes no common sense. And I don't believe any court in Colorado has ever said, or hopefully ever will say, that that does make common sense. I think absolutely the trial court has to have that discretion. And I think what's important to realize, and I realize I dropped my thing, is that Mr. Green never really tells you why the court abused its discretion. What constitutes an abuse of discretion, and why did the trial court abuse it? The bottom line, again, is that his argument is based on the fundamental concept that since there was an attorney fee provision in an express contract and none in an oral contract, the express contract trumps, and Colorado law simply does not support that position.
Counsel, I asked your counterpart, Mr. Green, about the Wheeler case, and I pointed him to the language that said, in a proper case, the trial court may rule that neither party prevailed and award no fees. He then cited it back to Spencer Contractor in an Illinois case and talked about the equitable versus a contract claim, a division. Do you remember that discussion?
I do remember that, Your Honor.
Can you respond to his argument that if there's an exception carved out, it really only applies when one side has an equitable claim and the other side has a contract claim?
Well, first of all, again, I think that Justice Corliss, if I understand your question correctly, has answered that question, that if there is an oral contract arising out of the same basic original express contract, and if it's executed subsequent to the execution of the original contract, that it incorporates an attorney fees provision into it, because it's essentially just a modification, an amendment, if you will, of the original contract. Also, what he didn't point out in the Wheeler case, quoting from the Court of Appeals at page 503, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor. It says, however, we recognize that in a proper case, the trial court may rule that neither party prevailed and award no cost. And what is its cite for its authority? It says, see Dennis I. Spencer Contracting, Inc. versus City of Aurora. It's right there in the same paragraph. So obviously the Court of Appeals has felt in the past that there could be circumstances in which, considering everything as a whole, neither party prevailed. And that, again, only makes common sense. Now, if you just have a plaintiff that's filed a lawsuit and there are no counterclaims and the plaintiff prevails, and maybe the plaintiff doesn't prevail to the full extent that it asks, that probably would be a different circumstance, because the trial court would say, well, only one party prevailed, and even though you didn't get everything you asked for, you did prevail. The defendant didn't prevail on anything. But in this particular case, our client, the plaintiff, recovered everything it asked for and defeated five of the six other claims. And at the end of the day, the total judgment after the net judgment rule was less than $2,000. And the attorney fees that they asked for were far in excess of that. And I think under the circumstances, the trial court was in the best position, and there are plenty of appellate decisions that support the fact that the trial court's in the best position to determine if a party prevailed or not. They heard all the evidence. Appellate courts do not. And the trial court determined at the end of the day as to what was asked by the defendant and what was asked by the plaintiff that neither party prevailed. It was such an inconsequential difference. I think I calculated up, if my math was correct, it was like 0.002% of what the defendant asked for that they recovered. And there's got to be common sense, and the trial court has got to have that discretion. Otherwise, you'll be strapping a court to say, as in my example, one party recovered $1,001, the other party recovered $1,000, therefore the party that recovered $1 more is the prevailing party. It's, since there's something in the contract that says the prevailing party shall be awarded their attorney fees, they got to get their attorney fees.
But it would be a black and white rule that everybody understood.
It would be, you know, not every black and white rule is a reasonable rule, is an equitable rule. You could have, to use an extreme example, you could say anybody that crossed the street after the light turns red walking is subject to 20 days in jail. That would be black and white. Everybody would know about it. Would it be a reasonable rule? I don't think so. So just because it's understandable doesn't make it right and doesn't make it the proper thing to do in this case. And I think at the end of the day, I would ask you to affirm the trial court's decision and also to keep in the trial court's hands the discretion to determine when or if there's a prevailing party, and if so, what, if anything, they're entitled to receive. Thank you very much.
Judge Roman, you're exactly right. It does provide a black and white rule. That is exactly what Spencer Contractor does. It gives us a bright line that when you have monetary judgments, the prevailing party under the net judgment rule is the one entitled to attorney fees under an attorney fees provision of the contract. The only discretion the court has at that point is the reasonableness of the fees. It could be a $10 or a $1 judgment against a $100,000 claim for attorney fees. It's still a question, are those fees reasonable?
But Mr. Green, even as you, I think, conceded before, then Dennis Spencer Contractor itself has an exception by saying that the trial court has the discretion to determine who the prevailing party is. And as I understand your view, it's at least in a case where there's a damages claim on one side and an equitable claim on the other.
Yes, but that's the only circumstance. That's the only articulated circumstance that we follow from the thread of cases that have been cited or that are available for us to aid us in this decision. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.